E to her bond. Son of a bitch, snapped Sanchia. I'm not your hostage. I'm not doing this for nothing. You would be doing it because you owe it to me, and for the good of the city. It's not my damned city, it's yours. I just live here, or try to, but you people are making it goddamn hard. He looked surprised by her ferocity. He considered it. Find the rig if you can, he said. Then we'll talk. I am not unreasonable when it comes to these things.
Could have scrumming fooled me, said Sanchia.
She stood, opened the door to the workshop, and walked inside.
Hey! Orso called after her. Hey! Don't touch anything in there, all right?
Walking into Orso Ignacio's workshop would have been startling to anyone. The amount of stuff, the sheer ungodly avalanche of so many things, was awe-inspiring. The workshop was a large, long room, containing 6 long tables piled up with bowls of cooled metals, as well as styli, wooden buttons, and dozens of machines, devices, contraptions, or parts of them. Some of the rigs were moving, twirling ever so slowly or arrhythmically clunking away. Where the walls weren't covered with bookcases, they were covered with papers, drawings, engravings, sigil strings, and maps. The oddest device sat in the back, some kind of giant metal can full of disks covered in scribings. It sat on rails that would slide it back into what appeared to be some kind of oven set in the wall, like the one they made pies in at the Greens. She supposed it was a test lexicon, a tiny version of the real thing. She'd heard of them from the scrappers, but she'd certainly never seen one before. It was a lot to see, but to Sanchia, it was deafening. The room echoed and swarmed with quiet chanting. All these scribed devices muttering like a rookery of uneasy crows. Sanchia's mind was still weak after saving Orso, so it was like rubbing sand on a sunburn. One thing's for sure, she thought. These people are doing a hell of a lot more than the scrappers ever were. She started stalking through the room, listening carefully. She walked past the innards of some component, dissected and laid out on a piece of linen. Then a set of bizarre scribed tools, which all seemed to be vibrating softly. Then rows and rows of blank black boxes that were curiously veiled in shadow, as if they sucked up light itself. If something in here is a traitor, she thought, I don't know how I'm going to identify it. She wished Clef were awake. He'd sniff it out right away. Then she glimpsed something on the wall and stopped. Hanging on the wall between 2 bookcases was a large charcoal sketch of Clef. It wasn't perfect. The tooth was all wrong. But the head, with its odd butterfly-shaped hole, was perfect. Sanchia walked closer to it and saw there was a handwritten note scrawled at the bottom. What could it open? For what grand lock was this designed? This guy has been thinking about Clef for a lot longer than I have, she thought. Maybe he knows more than he's letting on, just as I do. Then she saw there was a smudge at the bottom of the sketch. At the bottom, where the paper was crinkled. Someone must have pinched the paper there repeatedly. She reached out, grabbed the paper, and lifted it, and saw there was something behind the sketch of Clef. It was a large engraving, and the sight disturbed her. The engraving depicted a group of men standing in a hall. They looked like monks, wearing plain robes, though each robe bore a curious insignia, perhaps the outline of a butterfly she couldn't quite tell. She found she did not like the sight of the hall. It was a massive, ornate stone chamber, huge and blocky with angles in all the wrong places. It felt like light bent in the wrong ways in that room. At the end of the hall was a box, like a giant casket or treasure chest. The group looked on as one man stood before the box, raised his hands, and seemed to open it by will alone. Emerging from this open box was something. A person, perhaps. Perhaps a woman, or perhaps a statue, though there was something indistinct about the figure, like the artist had not been sure what they were depicting. Sanchia looked at the print at the bottom of the engraving. It read, "Chrysides the Great in the chamber at the center of the world. The Hierophants are recorded as believing the world is a machine wrought by God, and somewhere at its heart is a chamber which was once his seat. Chrysides, finding the seat of God vacant, attempted to install a god of his own making in the chamber to oversee the world. This engraving, like so many sources, suggests he was successful. But if he was, it does not explain why his grand empire fell to ash and ruin." She shivered, looking at the engraving. She remembered what Claudia and Giovanni had said the Hierophants could do. Then, she remembered what Clef did to the gravity rig. The vision of the man in the desert, turning out the stars. She imagined what a man like Orso Ignacio could do with Clef, and shivered again. Then she heard it. A chattering, a murmuring. But this one was louder than the others. That's unusual. She shut her eyes, listening to it, and walked to the back of the room. The sound was much louder here. Just like the gravity plates, she thought. So maybe it's either really powerful or made by the same person? She realized the noise was coming from a desk at the back, some kind of drafting table where Orso scrawled out strings of sigils. She tilted her head to it, listening to the pencils, the inkpots, the blocks of stone, and then a small golden statue of a bird sat on the corner of the desk. Sweating, Sanchia picked it up and held it up to her ear. The sound of it was almost deafening to her. "If it's anything in this room," she thought, "it's this." She set it back down, feeling quite pleased. She'd never used her talents like this before. As she walked back to the office, she wondered, ever so briefly, what else she could do. 10 minutes later, they all huddled around a table in Orso's workshop, watching as he turned the golden statue over. There was a small copper plate on the bottom with a large screw in the center. Orso glanced around at them, held a finger to his lips, picked up a screwdriver, and began to unscrew it. He gently, gently plucked the screw out, and then, with a tiny, flat tool, pried out the plate. Orso's mouth fell open in a silent gasp. Inside the statue was a device, but a device so tiny, so fragile, it was like it was made of spider webs and mouse bones. He grabbed a light and a magnifying glass and peered carefully at it. His eyes shot wide, and he gestured to Berenice, who also took a look. She blinked, startled, and looked at Orso, who nodded, his face serious. Finally, the inspection was finished. Orso gingerly placed the device on the table, and they all crept back into the office. Orso shut the door to his workshop, and then he erupted. "I've been a goddamn fool," he shouted. "I've been a slack-jawed, crotch-pawing fool." "So, it seems your suspicion was correct?" asked Gregor.
"Of course," cried Orso. "God, we're in a state. Who knows what they've heard? What have I said in front of that stupid little bird? And I never, never, never would have known."
"You're welcome," said Sanchia.
"That statue is an exact copy of one that once sat on my desk," he continued, ignoring her. I suppose they must have replaced it long ago with an altered version.
By flying up using those rigs, said Gregor.
Yes, said Berenice, shaken. And whoever made that thing is good.
Damned good, said Orso. Amazingly good. That's top-rate work there. I feel sure if someone was that good in this city, we'd all know about it. Everyone would be lining up to lick his candle. I've no doubt.
Gregor pulled a face.
Thank you for that elaboration.
Have you ever seen anything like it, Captain? Asked Orso. You're more well-traveled than I am, and the houses have used a lot of experimental stuff during the wars. Have you seen any military faction using rigs like this?
He shook his head.
No, and the only thing I've ever seen that was similar to the gravity rigs is a Lorica, and those rigs far outclassed any Lorica.
What's a Lorica? Asked Sanchia.
It's a scribed suit of armor, said Gregor. But unlike the armor we have here in Tavan, which is scribed to be both preternaturally light and preternaturally strong, a Lorica also augments the movements of the person within it. It amplifies their gravity, in other words, making them faster and stronger than a normal person.
I thought scribing gravity was illegal, said Sanchia.
It is, said Gregor, which is why Loricas are only used abroad in the wars, and in limited numbers at that.
He rubbed his face.
Now, can we focus on the consequential conclusions, please?
Yeah, said Sanchia. What the hell do we do about this? Can't you look at that thing and figure out, I don't know, something?
Berenice took a breath.
Well, what I believe we saw in there was an advanced version of twinning.
What, like the explosive I used at the waterfront? And that plate of yours? Asked Sanchia.
Exactly. But what's been twinned is a tiny, tiny, tiny needle in the center of the device. A delicate one that's somehow terribly sensitive to noise.
How is a needle sensitive to noise? Asked Gregor.
Because sound travels through the air, said Berenice, in waves.
Sanchia and Gregor stared at her.
It does, said Sanchia.
Like the ocean, said Gregor.
We don't have time to amend your dog shit educations, said Orso. Assume that yes, it does. The sound hits the needle and it shakes it. The needle vibrates, but it's twinned, so there's another needle that vibrates with it somewhere.
And that's the tricky part, said Berenice. What then? This second needle vibrates, and then...
Oh, come on, Berenice, said Orso. It's obvious. The second needle scratches its vibrations into a soft surface, tar or rubber or wax of some kind, and that surface hardens.
Her eyes grew wide. Then you can run another needle through the surface, through all the scratches, and it'll duplicate the noise.
Right. It'd be a shitty rendition, but it'd be enough to catch words.
Wait, said Gregor, holding up a hand. Are you really saying someone has come up with a scribed method of capturing sounds out of the air?
That's crazy, said Sanchia. So you could make the same sound or conversation over and over and over again?
You just use some magic ear bullshit to find that damn thing, said Orso angrily, pointing at the door. And a flying man just tried to throw me off the roof. Our idea of crazy is obviously in need of some updates.
But this is some delicate twinning, said Berenice.
How is that significant? Asked Gregor.
Twinning is a proximal effect, she said.
Usually the two twinned items don't have to be too close, since the effects you want to twin often aren't complicated. Like a detonator, it's motion, friction, and heat. You can twin those effects over miles. But this is much more complicated.
Orso stopped pacing.
So the second needle has to be very close, he said. You're right, Berenice. The apparatus that writes down the sound, that engraves the vibrations in wax, it has to be somewhere near for it to accurately capture all the sounds.
Somewhere on the property, sir, said Berenice. Probably somewhere in this very building. That's the only way to make it work properly.
You, Orso pointed at Sanchia. Do the thing again and find it.
Sanchia froze. That was far, far beyond her talents. Hearing a powerful device in a single room was one thing, but combing an entire building to find a specific rig was quite another. She'd need Clef for that, if he ever spoke again.
To her relief, Gregor cleared his throat.
That will have to wait, he said.
What? Said Orso. Why, damn it?
Gregor nodded to the window.
Because the sun is rising. People will be coming here soon, and when they do, it would probably be best if they did not find a blood-spattered girl wandering the halls with a blood-spattered Hepatis.
Orso sighed.
God damn it! We're running out of time.
What do you mean? Said Gregor.
I have a Tavani Council meeting tomorrow about the Commons blackouts. Tons of merchant house officers from all four houses will be there, along with me and Ophelia. I'll be seen by loads of people.
So word'll get out that you're not dead, said Sanchia, which will tip off whoever sent these assassins. And they'll come for the captured sounds, to see what happened, said Berenice.
Right, said Orso. We've got to get to it. Before them.
We'll return as soon as we can, said Gregor. But for now, we need a place to clean up.
Orso thought about it. Then he turned to Berenice and said,
Check out a carriage again, and take them to my house. Get them bathed and cleaned up. They can spend the day there, but this is not a permanent fix. Even the inner enclaves aren't safe.
Chapter 15 Berenice checked out a small passenger carriage and drove them north, grumbling a touch about not being a damned house servant. Sanchia stared out the windows as they drove. She hadn't really been paying attention before, but now she couldn't stop staring at the inner Dandolo enclaves. The strangest thing about them was that almost all of them glowed. The entire enclaves glowed a soft, warm, rosy color that seemed to emanate from the corners of the huge towers or from the bases, perhaps. It was hard to tell. She suspected that scribed lights had been built into the facades, lights that had been designed to cast indirect luminescence so no beams of light shone into anyone's windows at night. There were other wonders, of course. There were floating lanterns, like the ones her client had used to search for her. They floated in flocks above the main fairways like schools of jellyfish. There were also many narrow canals, full of needle-shaped boats with reclining seats. She imagined residents hopping in a boat and being zipped off across the waters to their destination. It was unreal. To imagine that people lived in muddy alleys mere miles from here, that she herself had lived in a squalid rookery that shared the same rain clouds as this place. She glanced at Berenice and Gregor. Berenice was totally indifferent to it all. Gregor, on the other hand, had a faint scowl on his face. Finally, they came to a tall, gated mansion, the sort of place for a prestigious Campo official. It was impossible to imagine Orso Ignacio living here, yet the copper gates silently parted before them. The Hepatis bound them to respond to my blood, said Berenice. She didn't sound too happy about it. Along with his own, of course. It's a favorite trick of his.
He rarely comes here.
Why wouldn't he come to the goddamn mansion he owns? Asked Sanchia.
He gets the house as a condition of his position. He didn't go out and buy the place. I don't think he actually cares about it at all.
This became apparent when they walked inside. The carpets, tables, and lanterns all bore a faint coating of dust.
Where does he sleep? Asked Sanchia.
In his office, said Berenice. I think. I've never actually seen him sleep.
She gestured to the stairs. The bedrooms are upstairs on the fourth floor, as are the bathing facilities. I suggest you both use them if you're going to be on the campo, in case someone spots you. It would be wise if you looked the part.
She looked at them and wrinkled her nose. And you don't, right now.
Gregor thanked her, and Berenice departed. Sanchia wandered upstairs to the third floor, where she found an immense set of window doors that opened onto the balcony. She opened them, stepped out, and looked. The Dandolo inner enclaves curled out before her, bright and creamy and pink as a rose. There was a park across the cobblestone fairway with a hedge maze and bursting flowers. People were walking the paths together. It was a stupefying idea to Sanchia. In the commons, if you were outdoors at night, there was a decent chance you'd die.
They went a bit overboard, didn't they?
Said Gregor's voice behind her.
Eh?
Said Sanchia. He stood beside her.
With the lights, the Daulos call us the Glowmen in their language, because we tend to put lights on everything.
Something you picked up in the Enlightenment Wars?
Yes.
He turned to her, leaning up against the balcony.
Now, our deal.
You want my client, said Sanchia.
I want your client,
he said.
Very much so, if you can give him to me.
In what condition? You want his name, his head, or what?
No, no, said Gregor. No heads. These are the stakes of our deal. You not only help me find him, but also get the evidence I need to expose him. I don't want his name, his money, his company, or his blood. I want ramifications. I want consequences.
You want justice, she said, sighing.
I want justice, yes.
And why do you think I can help you get it?
Because you have evaded nearly every effort to kill you or seize you, and you stole from me. You are, and this is not a compliment, mind, a very accomplished sneak, and I suspect we will need someone with your talents if we are to succeed.
But this is a tall goddamn order, said Sanchia. Sark said he thought our client was founder lineage, just like you or someone close to it. That means me working in places like this.
She nodded at the city below. In the enclaves, the places that are basically designed to make sure people like me die the second I step foot in them.
I'll help you. And Orso will too.
Why would Orso help me?
To get back his key, of course,
said Gregor.
Along with any other occidental treasures the man's been hoarding. Our opponent has stolen two items from Orso, and seems to have acquired a third, this Imperiat. No doubt there's more.
No doubt.
She suppressed the flicker of anxiety in her belly. She wasn't sure what seemed harder, delivering Founderkin to Gregor, or returning a treasure she wasn't supposed to have.
So, I help you get this justice of yours. And then you let me go?
In essence.
She shook her head. Justice? God, why are you doing all this? Why are you out here risking your life?
Is justice such an odd thing to desire?
Justice is a luxury.
No,
said Gregor.
It is not. It is a right. And it is a right that has long been denied.
He stared out at the city. The chance for reform. For real, genuine reform for this city. I would shed every drop of blood in my body for such a thing. And then, of course, there is the fact that if we fail, then a vicious person will possess tools of near divine power, which I, personally, would find quite bad.
He took out the key to her bond and held it out.
You can do the honors yourself, I believe.
I thought Orso was crazy, she said, unlocking the bond. But you're really crazy.
I'd thought you would be more amenable to the idea than others, he said lightly.
And why is that?
For the same reason I think wearing that bond irked you so, Sanchia, he said. And the same reason you conceal the scars on your back.
She froze and slowly turned to stare at him.
What? She said softly. I am a traveled man, Sanchia, he said. I know the look of you. I have seen such things before, though I hope I never will again.
She stepped forward, sticking her finger in his face. No, she said fiercely. No! He drew back, startled. I am not having this conversation with you, she said. Not now, maybe not ever. He blinked.
All right.
She slowly lowered her finger.
You don't know a goddamn thing about me, she said.
Then she walked back indoors. She stalked upstairs, found a bedroom, and shut and locked the door. She stood there in the darkened room, breathing hard. Then a voice spoke up in her mind.
That was a bit of an overreaction, wasn't it, kid?
Clef, she said. Holy shit, you're alive.
As much as a key could be, yeah.
How long have you been, I don't know, there?
Just now. That was the first time I've seen the captain look scared of anyone. How about getting me the hell out of your shoe?
She sat down in the middle of the floor, hauled her boot off, and held him in her bare hands. Then she pummeled him with questions. Where did you go, Clef? How did you do that thing with the gravity rig? Are you hurt? Are you all right? He was silent for a long time.
No, he said in a quiet voice. No, I'm not all right, but we'll get to that. First, where are we? Are we in, like, a mansion?
She tried to catch him up as fast as she could.
So, he said, you're working for the captain now?
Kind of. I like to think it's more of a partner thing, personally.
He can still kill you at any time, right?
Well, yeah.
Then you're not partners. You're also working for this Orso guy, the guy who tried to buy me, and you're going to steal, me back for him?
I think I vaguely agreed to that.
How's that going to work?
If you haven't figured out yet that I'm making this up as I go, Clef, I don't know what to tell you. Clef said nothing for a bit. A flock of floating lanterns trickled through the street below, casting pulsing pink light on the ceiling. How did you do that thing with the gravity rig, Clef? She asked. How did you make it control the gravity of everything? And what happened to you?
It's hard for me to explain, he said, sighing. It's all a matter of boundaries. I can't make a scribed device do anything beyond its own boundaries. I can't make a rig that heats up iron, then turn that iron into clay or snow or whatever, in other words.
So,
with the gravity rig, its boundaries were really, really big and really, really vague. It gave me a lot to work with, even though the device itself couldn't stand the strain, because the more a rig pushes against its boundaries, the more it falls apart. And when I made it do that, I remembered something. And then I fell asleep and dreamed.
You fell asleep? What did you remember?
I remembered someone else who'd been able to manipulate gravity.
Someone from long ago. A shadow of a person to me now.
His voice took on a dreamy cadence.
He could make anything float. And whenever he wished, he could fly through the air like a sparrow in the night.
Sanchia's skin crawled. But, Clef, the only people who've ever been able to fly were the Hierophants.
Yeah, I know. I think I was remembering the person who made me, Sanchia.
She didn't know what to say to that.
The Hierophants are all dead, aren't they?
He asked. Yes.
That makes me feel alone,
he said quietly.
And frightened.
Why frightened?
Because when I dreamed, I remembered my making. I can show you, if you like.
What do you mean, show me?
Here, I'm going to put something into your mind now, something small. Think of it like you're in the water swimming, and I'm going to throw you a line. Focus and grab onto it.
Okay. There was a pause. And then, she felt it. Or rather, she heard it. It was a quiet, rhythmic tap, 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 tap.
A soft series of beats and pulses echoing through her mind. She listened to it, reached out, grasped it, and then the beats unfolded, expanded, and enveloped her, filling her thoughts. And then the memory took her. Sand. Darkness. Quiet, anxious mutterings from somewhere nearby. She was lying on a stone surface, staring up into the darkness.
Midnight, she thought to herself.
When the world grinds to a stop and then restarts. She knew that, but she didn't know how she knew it.
Then a flame, bright and hot, molten metal glowing in the shadows. She felt pain, fierce and terrible, piercing her, running her through. And she heard herself cry out. But it wasn't her. She was someone else, she knew that. And then, suddenly, she felt herself fill this form, this function, this design. She felt her mind flooding into the shaft, the teeth, the notches, the tip. She became the key, became this thing, this apparatus. Yet she now understood that she was to be much, much more than a key. A compendium, a compilation, a device filled with so, so much knowledge of scribings, of sigils, of the language and makeup of the world. A tool, bright and terrible, just like a blade is meant to part wood or flesh, she was meant to part. Sanchia gasped, and the memory released her. It was too much. Too much. She was back in the bedroom, yet she was so stunned she nearly collapsed.
Did you see?
Clef asked. She tried to catch her breath. That was you? That happened to you?
This is a memory I have. I'm not sure if it's mine or someone else's, because I'm not totally sure it happened to me. It's all I know.
But if that's how you were made, Clef, it seems like you weren't always a key. It seemed like, for a second there, you used to be a person.
More silence. Then,
yeah, weird, right? I'm not sure what to think of that. Perhaps that's why I remember the taste of wine, and what it feels like to sleep, and the smell of the desert at night.
He laughed sadly.
I don't think I was supposed to know.
Know what?
To know myself. I'm a device, Sanchia. They took me and they put me inside this thing. And rigs aren't supposed to be self-aware. It's like you said when we first met. I sat in the dark for so long. I wasn't supposed to wait that long.
Pause.
You know what that means, don't you? I'm a machine that's falling apart, and eventually I won't work. I think I'm dying. Do you see?
She sat there for a moment, stunned. What? Clef, are you sure?
I can feel it happening.
me being sentient. I'm like a tumor inside the key. I grow and I grow, but I'm not what was intended. I'm an error, and it's breaking the rest of me apart. And the people who could fix me, they're all dead. They died hundreds, if not thousands, of years ago.
Sanchia swallowed. She'd imagined many horrors when it came to Clef. Mostly that he might fall into the wrong hands, or she might lose him. But the idea of him dying had never occurred to her. How long do you have?
I'm not sure. It's a process. The more I do, the more I break down. So it could be months, or it could be weeks.
So I can't use you.
No, he said firmly. I want you to use me, Sanchia. I want to do things with you, to be alive with you, to help you. You're the only person I can remember ever truly knowing. I'm not even sure if I want to be fixed, to be honest, even if someone could fix me. Because then I'd go back to my original state, a device with no mind at all.
She sat there, trying to process this. I don't know what to think about this.
Then don't. I think you need rest. I also think you need a bath.
People keep telling me that.
That's because you do.
I can't bathe. I can't sit in water. That's too much contact. It'll kill me.
Well, try something at least. It'll make you feel better.
She hesitated, then walked into the bathing room. It was all marble and metal with a huge porcelain tub, and it had mirrors, something she'd seen only rarely in her life. She looked around for a place to hide Clef in case someone walked in, and settled on a cabinet.
Don't hate Captain Dandolo,
said Clef as she set him down.
I think he's broken, just like you and me. He's just trying to fix the world because it's the only way he knows to fix himself.
Sanchia shut the cabinet. Alone in the bathing room, Sanchia stripped down. Then she looked at herself in the mirrors. Her arms and thighs and shoulders, strong and rippling and wiry. Her belly and breasts, covered in rashes and bites and filth. She turned around and saw her back. She took a sharp breath in. She thought they'd have gone away by now or shrunk, but they seemed just as huge as ever, the bright, shiny strips of scars that ran from her shoulders down to her buttocks. She stared at them, transfixed. It had been so long since she'd last seen them, for mirrors were rare in the commons. They'd told stories of slaves that had bravely borne countless whippings, stoically taking lash after lash. But the instant she'd been whipped, Sanchia had realized it had all been a lie. The second the lash had touched her, all her pride and fury and hope had been dashed away. It was surprising how fragile your idea of yourself was. Sanchia stood in the tub, soaked a cloth in hot water, and scrubbed herself clean. As she did, she told herself she was not a slave anymore. She told herself she was free and strong, that she'd been alone for years, and she'd be alone again one day. And she would, as always, survive. Because surviving was what Sanchia did best. And as she scrubbed at her filthy, scarred skin, she tried to tell herself that the drops on her cheeks were just water from the spigots, and nothing more. Part 2. Campo. And so Great Crisides came to the city of Apamea, on the edge of the Sea of Ephias. And though no text survives of what he said to the kings of this city, it is clear from second-hand sources that he brought his usual message of co-option, of integration into their empire, and urgings of surrender. By now word had spread of the Hierophant's arrival in the region, and many were fearful.
but the kings and wealthy landowners of Apamea refused him and rudely rebuffed Great Chrysides. Chrysides did not respond with any wrath, as some had feared. Instead, he simply walked to the city square, where he sat in the dust and began to build a cairn out of gray stones. The legend goes that Chrysides built the cairn from noon to sunset, and the height of the construct grew to be extraordinary. Exact accounts differ regarding the height. Some say 100 feet tall, others hundreds of feet. However, every version of the story omits two critical parts. If the cairn of stones was extraordinarily tall, how did Chrysides, an average man in height, manage to keep stacking the stones on the top? It was said Chrysides could make many things float and could fly himself. But this is not noted in this story. So, how? And secondly, where did all these stones come from? Some sources suggest that Chrysides had assistance in the construction of the cairn. These renditions claim that, before he began, Chrysides took out a small metal box and opened it, though the box appeared to be empty to onlookers. However, the stories say that the people of Apamea then saw footprints forming in the dust around the cairn, footprints far larger than a person's. These versions would suggest that Chrysides had held some kind of invisible sprite or entity within the box, which he released to aid him. Yet such tales hew close to some of the more fantastical stories regarding the Hierophants. Fables of Chrysides making the stars dance with his magic wand, and so on, and thus must be treated with skepticism. Regardless of the particulars, Chrysides began to build the cairn and did not stop. And as night fell, and as they watched this curious display, the people of Apamea suddenly grew fearful and left. In the morning, when they returned to the city square, Chrysides was seated in the dust, still waiting patiently, and the cairn was gone. As were, the people later discovered, all the kings and wealthy landowners of Apamea, along with their families, old and young, and all their livestock, and the very buildings they'd lived and worked in. All had vanished overnight without a sound, perhaps taken to the place that the cairn had also gone. The purpose of the cairn remains unknown, as does the final destination of those who resisted Chrysides in Apamea, who are still lost to history. Apamea, of course, no longer resisted Chrysides and submitted to the rule of the Hierophants, though it, like all of the lands of the Occidental Empire, was eventually totally destroyed. As is well documented, it is unknown if a civil war was the source of this conflict, or if, perhaps, the Hierophants battled against another, greater force. Such an idea troubles me, and yet it must be considered. Giancomo Adorni, Deputy Hippotas of the House of Guarco, Collected Tales of the Occidental Empire. Chapter 16. Orso ground his teeth, rubbed his forehead, and sighed.
"I swear," he murmured, "if I hear one more insipid shitting word."
"Quiet," whispered Ophelia Dandolo.
Orso rested his head on the table before him. He was talented at putting abstract concepts together. That was essentially his entire profession. He wrote essays and arguments that convinced reality to do some new and interesting things. So, if there was one thing he truly despised, one thing that absolutely, positively drove him mad, it was when someone just could not get to the scrumming point. To observe someone fumbling around with words and ideas like a schoolboy trying to navigate a woman's underrobes was akin to swallowing shards of glass.
"The point is thusly,"
said the speaker, a Morsini deputy Hippotas, some overdressed asshole whose name Orso couldn't be bothered to remember.
The point is it possible to develop criteria by which we can measure, analyze, and establish the possibility that the Commons blackouts were a natural occurrence, by which I mean some byproduct of a storm or meteorological fluctuation in the atmosphere, as opposed to being anthropological, by which I mean human-caused.
Little shit probably just learned the word,
growled Orso. Ophelia Dandolo glanced at him. Orso cleared his throat as if the comment had been a cough. This was now hour four of this Tavani Council meeting on the blackouts. To his surprise, they'd somehow managed to drag both Eferizo Michiel and Torino Morsini out of their Campo cradles. You almost never saw either househead at all, let alone in the same place. Eferizo was trying to sit up and look nobly concerned, whereas Torino was nakedly emanating boredom. Ophelia, as always, comported herself quite well, in Orso's opinion. But he could see even her stamina was flagging. Yet Orso was quite alert. He kept looking from face to face, thinking. This room contained some of the most powerful men in the city, and many of them were founder lineage. If anyone acted surprised to see him alive, well, that would be a helpful indication. Ophelia cleared her throat. There is no recorded, natural occurrence of scrying blackouts, she said. Not like a typhoon or some such, anyways. Neither in our history, nor that of the Occidentals. So, why don't we cut to the chase and simply ask, was this the product of something we did here in Tavan? The room swelled up with muttering.
Are you accusing another merchant house of this act, Founder?
Demanded a Morsini representative. I accuse no one, said Ophelia, for I understand nothing. Could it not have been an accidental effect of some research endeavor? The muttering grew louder.
Ridiculous, someone said.
Preposterous.
Outrageous!
If Dandolo chartered, is willing to make such a supposition, said one of the Michiel deputies. Perhaps the Dandolo hypothesis can provide us with some supporting research?
All eyes turned to look at Orso.
Great, he thought.
He cleared his throat and stood.
I must slightly correct my founder's testimony, he said. There is, in hierophantic history, one obscure legend in which the phenomenon we witnessed possibly appears. The Battle of Armeades.
He coolly looked around at the gathered crowd.
Come on, you bastard, he thought. Break for me. Show yourself. Such methodologies remain beyond the abilities of Devon, of course, he said. But if we trust our histories, then it is possible.
One of the Morsinis sighed, exasperated.
More Irophants, more magicians! What more could we expect from a disciple of Tribuno Candiano?
The room went silent at that. Everyone stared at the Morsini representative, who slowly grew aware that he had greatly overstepped.
I apologize, he said.
He turned toward a part of the room that had hitherto remained quiet.
I misspoke, sirs.
Everyone slowly turned to look at the portion of the room dominated by Company Candiano representatives. There were far fewer of them than the other houses. Sitting in the founder's seat was a young man of about 30, pale and clean-shaven, wearing dark green robes and an ornate flat cap trimmed with a large emerald. He was an oddity in many ways. For one, he was about a third of the age of the other three founders. And he was not, as everyone knew, an actual founder, or indeed a blood relation to the Candiano family at all. Orso narrowed his eyes at the young man. For though Orso hated many people in Tavan,
You especially loathed Tomas Ziani, the chief officer of Company Candiano. Tomas Ziani cleared his throat and stood.
You did not misspeak, sir, he said. My predecessor, Tribuno Candiano, brought great ruin to our noble house with his Occidental fascinations.
Our noble house, thought Orso. You married into it, you little shit.
Tomas nodded at Orso.
An experience that the Dandolo Hippotas, of course, is keenly aware of.
Orso gave him the thinnest of smiles, bowed, and sat.
It is, of course, preposterous to imagine that any Tavani merchant house is capable of reproducing any hierophantic effects, said Tomas Ziani, let alone one that could have accomplished the blackouts, to say nothing of the moral implications. But I regret to say that Founder Dandolo has not truly cut to the quick of the question. What I think we all want to know is, if we want to find out if any merchant house is behind the blackouts, how shall we institute this authority? What body shall have this oversight? And who shall make up this body?
The room practically exploded with discontented mutterings.
And with that, Orso thought with a sigh, young Tomas delivers the killing blow to this idiot meeting.
For this notion was heresy in Tavan. The idea of some kind of municipal or governmental authority that could inspect the business of the merchant houses? They would genuinely rather fail and die than submit to that. Ophelia sighed. A handful of tiny white moths flitted around her head. What a waste of time, she said softly, waving them away. Orso glanced at Tomas and found, to his surprise, that the young man was watching him. Specifically, he was looking at Orso's scarf, very, very hard.
Maybe not entirely, he said.
When the meeting closed, Orso and Ophelia held a brief conference in the cloisters. To confirm, she said quietly, you do not think this is sabotage?
No, Founder, he said.
Why are you so certain?
Because I have a grubby thief who says she saw it happen, he thought.
But, he said,
if it was sabotage, they could have done a hell of a better job. Why target the commons? Why only glancingly affect the Campos?
Ophelia Dandolo nodded.
Is there a reason to suspect sabotage, Founder? He asked.
She gave him a piercing look. Let's just say, she said reluctantly, that your recent work on light could attract attention. This was interesting to him. Orso had been fooling around with scribed lights for decades, but it was only at Dandolo Chartered, with its superior lexicon architecture, that he'd started trying to engineer the reverse, scribing something so it absorbed light, rather than emitting it, producing a halo of perpetual shadow, even in the day. So the suggestion that Ophelia Dandolo might worry about other houses fearing this technology, that was curious.
What exactly, he wondered, is she planning to veil in shadow?
As in all things, she said, I expect your secrecy or so, but especially there.
Certainly, Founder.
Now, if you will excuse me, I have a meeting shortly.
I as well, he said. Good day, Founder.
He watched her go, then turned and swept out to the hallways around the council building, where the legions of attendants and administrators and servants hovered to assist the throngs of great and noble men within. Among them was Berenice, yawning and rubbing her puffy eyes.
Just 4 hours? She said. That was quick, sir.
Was it?
said Orso, rushing past her. He walked through the crowd of people dressed in white and yellow, Dandolo chartered colors, and moved on to the red and blue crowd, Morsini House, and then the purple and gold crowd, which was, of course, Michiel Body Corporate.
Said Berenice, where are we going, sir?
You are going somewhere to sleep, said Orso. You'll need it tonight.
And when will you sleep, sir?
When do I ever sleep, Berenice?
I see, sir.
He stopped at the crowd of people dressed in dark green and black, company Candiano colors. This crowd was much smaller and much less refined. The effects of the Candiano bankruptcy still lingered, it seemed.
What would you be planning to do here, sir?
Asked Berenice with a touch of anxiety.
Ask questions, he said.
He peered through the crowd. At first, he wasn't sure she'd be there, and thought himself absurd for even imagining it. But then, he saw her. One woman, standing apart from the group, her posture tall and noble. Orso stared at her, and instantly regretted this idea. The woman wore a bewilderingly complicated dress, with puffs on her upper sleeves, and her hair twisted up in an intricate brooch that was covered in pearls and ribbons. Her face was painted white, with the now fashionable painted blue bar across her eyes.
My God, said Orso quietly. She went in for all that aristocratic fluffery. I can't believe it.
Berenice glanced at the woman. Her eyes grew wide, and she stared at Orso in naked terror.
Don't, sir.
He flapped a hand at her.
Go home, Berenice.
Don't go talk to her. That would be deeply unwise.
He understood her fear perfectly. The idea of approaching the daughter of the founder of a competing merchant house was mad, especially if she was also the wife of the chief officer of that same house. But Orso had built a career on bad choices.
Enough, he said.
It would be outrageously inappropriate for you to approach her, she said. Whatever your...
He looked at her.
Whatever my what?
Berenice glared at him.
Whatever your history with her, sir.
My own affairs, said Orso, are just that, my own. And unless you want to get tangled up in them, I suggest you leave now, Berenice.
She looked at him for a moment longer. Then, sighing, she walked away. Orso watched her go. He swallowed and tried to compose himself.
Am I doing this for good reason? He wondered. Or just to talk to her?
He decided not to dither on it anymore. He pivoted on his heel and marched up to the woman.
That dress, he said, looks absurd on you.
The woman did a double take, her mouth open in outrage. Then she saw him, and the surprise evaporated from her face.
Ah, of course. Good afternoon, Orso.
She glanced around nervously. Many of the Candiano Company's servants were either staring or trying hard not to stare.
This is very inappropriate, you know. I guess I forget what appropriate means these days, Estelle.
My experience, Orso, suggests you never knew in the first place.
He grinned.
Does it? It is good to see you, Estelle. Even if you are stuffed into the back halls like a damned valet.
She smiled back, or at least tried to. It was not the smile he was familiar with. When he'd known her years ago, Estelle Candiano's eyes had been bright and alive, and her gaze had been sharper than a stiletto. Now there was something dull to them. She looked tired, even though she was still 12 years his junior. Estelle now looked old. She gestured ahead, and they moved out of earshot from the rest of the group.
Was it you who killed the meeting? She asked. 4 hours is a little short
Yes?
Not I. That would have been your husband.
Ah, what did Tomas say?
Some rather disparaging things about